Dr. William Luther Pierce, 2001, Poisonous Doctrines.
Hello. Today, let's begin by talking about individualism and individualists. I'm using those words in a special sense. In this broadcast today, when I say individualist, I mean a person who habitually fails to consider or to give proper weight to the group context in which he belongs when viewing the world, formulating ideas, and reaching decisions, and who, in evaluating other people, fails to put them into the group context to which they belong, instead focusing narrowly only on the individual at hand. I also will use the word individualist today to designate a person who makes an ideology out of his individualism. In this sense, an individualist is a person who believes that it is good, moral, admirable, proper, and so on, to disregard group contexts, and immoral, unpatriotic, reprehensible, and wicked not to do so. Actually, it's impossible to avoid group contexts, and the ideological individualist himself divides people into two groups, namely, individualists who, like himself, are good people, and collectivists who, like me, are bad people, akin to communists. I've spoken with you in earlier broadcasts about the ideology of individualism, and today I want to focus more on some of the practical implications of this attitude. I'll tell you first what prompted my choice of this subject today. 2 weeks ago, I said some unkind things about lawyers, judges, and our judicial system. And in response to that broadcast, I received a couple of indignant letters from lawyers who told me that I was both unfair and inaccurate in my negative characterization of lawyers. Not all lawyers are soulless, money-grubbing crooks, they told me. Some lawyers are decent, honest, patriotic people, they told me. Some lawyers agree with me about most things, and it is foolish to alienate them by calling all lawyers crooks. I need their support, and I will lose it if I continue to insult them. Well, I can't really disagree with that. I personally know a few lawyers who aren't crooks, and I certainly do want to retain their support. Looking at my broadcast of 2 weeks ago from an individualist viewpoint, it was both unfair and inaccurate. The individualist would say that I paint things with too broad a brush. I should say that some lawyers are crooks, and then the individualist will agree with me. Of course, the essence of my message 2 weeks ago was not that some lawyers are crooks. It was that the judicial system is corrupt. The system designed by lawyers and staffed by lawyers for the purpose of making and interpreting the laws is corrupt. The fact that every lawyer is in some sense a part of that system does not mean that every lawyer is corrupt. A few lawyers who are in the system are fighting against the system. I didn't say that 2 weeks ago because I wanted to keep my message simple and direct. I didn't want to distract my listeners from the main thrust of the message with qualifications and quibbles. It's an important message, and I wanted to make the strongest possible impression on my listeners. I deliberately paint with a broad stroke. Here's another example of the way in which people looking at things from an individualist viewpoint misunderstand my message. I'm often critical of the Christian churches, of their subservient collaboration with the Jews, of their encouragement of miscegenation, and their other racially destructive policies. And some Christians who agree with my positions on the Jews and on race take offense at my comments regarding the overall role of Christianity in our society today, and they tell me, hey, I'm offended. All Christians aren't race mixers and collaborators with the Jews. And of course, I understand that, I understand that there are many individual Christians who are good people, Christians who don't run with the Jews. But what I was talking about was the overall role of Christianity and the Christian churches in our society, and that role today is destructive. Another example, I often talk about the feminization of our society and the feminization of our young men. And I make it quite clear that I don't approve of these things. This offends some women who take what I say quite personally. An expression I used in one broadcast which offended several of my women listeners enough for them to send me indignant letters of protest was the phrase, college girls of both sexes. The implication was that college girls are not to be taken more seriously than feminized college boys. And another time I stated that permitting women to vote was a terrible mistake. And again I received letters from women who indignantly told me that they vote more responsibly than many men they know. Well, I'm sure they do. But I was talking about the overall effect of women's votes, and that has been very damaging to our society. Of course, women as a rule take everything personally. And so I explain individually to those who protest that I do take women seriously, that I value and respect them, and that I love them. But that I also understand that despite all of the fascinating individual differences among them, all of them are profoundly different from men. When I receive protests from lawyers and from male Christians, however, I see the individualist fallacy at work. Men should not look at the world as individualists. They should understand that it is not only natural and proper, but necessary to judge other men according to the group of which they are a part. Just as people have individual characteristics, they also have collective characteristics, and to ignore the latter from fear of being considered a racist or a sexist or an anti-Semite or a homophobe is the worst sort of folly. When one is in a war, one doesn't judge the soldiers on the other side as individuals. One doesn't hold one's fire because the fellow in the enemy's uniform who is charging with a rifle in his hands may really have wanted to be a conscientious objector instead of a combat infantryman. If he's in the enemy's uniform, one shoots at him. We understand, of course, that not all blacks are muggers or gangbangers or armed robbers or HIV-infected rapists. Just as we understand that not every Jew is a predator who is actively scheming to destroy our people after he has sucked us dry. When I look at a black, I may see a criminal or a welfare bum, or I may see an honest, hard-working person. But in either case, I see a black, and I understand what his race is doing to my race collectively. Even if an individual black with whom I am dealing is friendly, intelligent, and moral, I would be a fool to expect him to join me in a campaign to put an end to what his race is doing to my race and to my civilization collectively. I sometimes am obliged to deal with Jews, much more often, in fact, than with blacks, because Jews collectively have arrogated to themselves so many positions of control and influence in our society. And I'm able to distinguish among individual Jews. I see that many of them I deal with are tricky and deceitful, but there are some who are straightforward and sincere, I believe. Many are really hateful, but occasionally I meet one who is almost likable. Yet I never forget what Jews collectively as a whole are doing and have done to my people collectively. We must understand that we are in a planet-wide race war, and the survival of our race depends on our winning this war. We won't win by wasting our time trying to figure out who the friendly blacks are and who the hostile ones are. We won't win by refusing to talk about what the Jewish media bosses and the powerful Jewish organizations are doing to our people from fear that we may be unjustly casting suspicion on Jews who are simply minding their own business. We must deal with them collectively. And when the crunch comes, that's certainly the way they will deal with us. In fact, that's pretty much the way they already deal with us. When those gangs of blacks were running wild through the Mardi Gras crowd in Seattle a couple of weeks ago, savagely attacking white people, they didn't try to figure out which whites were racists and which ones were diversity-loving, race-mixing liberals. Their cry was, "Let's get a whitey. We gonna kick some white ass tonight." And they attacked any white target of opportunity they encountered. Speaking of the Fat Tuesday race riot in Seattle, which the national media have so successfully kept most of the country from hearing about, I have a few more thoughts to share with you on the subject. For one thing, I've been able to gather a little more information about what happened that night. Not only was there a series of vicious beatings and robberies of white men and women by gangs of rampaging blacks, there also was a series of sexual assaults. The controlled media were even more eager to keep these covered up than the beatings and robberies, but the news is leaking out, in Seattle at least. It was very similar to what happened in New York's Central Park last year, when a gang of blacks and Puerto Ricans grabbed white women who were walking in the park, ripped their clothes off, squeezed their breasts, pushed fingers into their vaginas, and otherwise abused and humiliated them. Just as in New York, in Seattle it was very definitely racial, often with both black males and black females collaborating in the sexual abuse of white women. And it was very definitely hostile. The same black gangs who were sexually abusing white women were viciously beating white women and white men. When it happened in Central Park, the news got out, primarily, I think, because a couple of very loud Jewish feminists were among those abused. In Seattle, it's been covered up, but now it is coming out after a fashion. I'll read just one line from a March 12th editorial in the Seattle Post-Intelligencer about just one woman who was being held down and abused on Fat Tuesday while a news reporter filmed the scene. Quote, "At one point there are 19 hands, black, Asian, Hispanic, on her body." End quote. Now I want to talk with you more about something I touched on at the beginning of last week's broadcast. And that's the behavior of the white people in Seattle's Mardi Gras crowd, both before and during the riot. I should begin by saying that it wasn't the way the local media and the Seattle police claimed it was, with hooligans of both races fighting it out. Whites did not attack blacks. It was entirely blacks attacking whites. I have had a chance now to study videotape footage of the riot, and the one-sided nature of the racial attacks is quite clear. What also is quite clear, however, is that many whites in the crowd were acting like blacks, and virtually all the whites were acting like lemmings. First, the whites acting like blacks. Wiggers, they are generally called, for an obvious reason. There were many young white men in the crowd wearing the backward baseball caps and baggy shorts, which are the trademark uniform of the wigger. Pathetic souls that they are. They have been robbed of any natural sense of racial identity and racial community by this utterly sick and depraved society in which we live. And I mean deliberately robbed with malice aforethought. The Jewish media and the public schools have played especially reprehensible roles in this destructive genocidal work. Everything which in healthier times helped give our young people a sense of collective racial identity and racial pride has been kept from them deliberately in the schools. The teaching of history and literature has become a joke. The Jews and the feminists and the egalitarians have ripped the guts out of everything in the schools which used to have white racial content. The multiculturalist ideologues think this is wonderful because it prepares our children to be world citizens in the new world order of multiculturalism and diversity. For the multiculturalists, it's a religion. But the conservative Republicans, who have made an ideology out of individualism, think it's fine, too. At least it's not collectivism. It's not racism. But having a sense of collective identity, a sense of who we are and what group we belong to, is what is natural. We evolved with a need for the sense of collective identity. That's the way we survived in the past. And so when the schools and the media rob the more lemming-like kids of their sense of identity, they look for a replacement. And the schools, and especially the Jewish media, have a ready-made replacement for them. They find it on Sumner Redstone's MTV. They find it in Black History Month, where they are told that everyone of worth, from the ancient Egyptian pharaohs to the inventors of the helicopter and television, were blacks. They find it in the glorification by the media of black basketball players and other black sports figures. They find it in the almost inescapable presence of black music promoted by the media. And they are made to understand that if they wear a Confederate flag patch on their shirts, they'll be expelled from school. But it's okay to wear a Malcolm X t-shirt to commemorate a black hero who wrote about how much he wanted to kill whites. And so we have wiggers imitating blacks in clothing styles, in speech patterns, in musical taste, and in behavior. That's why when we look at the video footage of Seattle's Fat Tuesday riot, we can see young white men acting like blacks, smashing windows, vandalizing cars, sometimes fighting with normal whites, pawing girls, and behaving in a generally animalistic way. Then there are the rest of the whites, the approximately normal whites. Two things are notable about them. First, they weren't expecting the blacks to misbehave. They were completely surprised when the blacks began attacking them. And second, they didn't fight back. With the notable exception of 20-year-old Chris Time, who was murdered by the blacks for behaving the way a white man should behave, they didn't even try to protect their own women. They just stood around and gaped at what was happening. To me, these two things are far more disturbing than what the blacks did. So why were the more or less normal whites surprised when the blacks began behaving like blacks? Why weren't they expecting that? Haven't we had enough experience with black behavior in America yet? And of course, the answer to that is that the normal whites are just as much lemmings as the wiggers are. The wiggers just show it in a more degenerate fashion. The wiggers are usually the lower IQ lemmings, the lower class, more impressionable lemmings. But the normal lemmings, most of them less than 30 years old, have been conditioned all their lives, just like the wiggers, by the Jewish media, by the schools, by the government, and by the Christian churches, to believe that blacks are the same as whites, except a little darker. Really, most young Americans believe that. And they're surprised every time reality conflicts with their belief. Every day I receive letters from distressed young lemmings who have heard one of my broadcasts or visited my website. They whine at me. Why can't you see that we're all the same? Don't you understand that the only difference between us and blacks is skin color? Don't you know that the only race is the human race? The scientists have proved it. And really, they all sound pretty much alike. They've had these lies drilled into their heads, and they parrot them back at me. And some of these lemmings are reasonably bright, educated people. They really believe that scientists have proved that there is no difference between blacks and whites. And I'm sorry to say, some scientists have contributed to this false belief, either because they are lemmings themselves and want to show that they are politically correct, or because they hope to improve their chances of getting another government research grant. Some of the scientists associated with the Human Genome Project, for example, have been quoted by the media as saying that the mapping of the human genome supports the notion that racial differences are insignificant. There is only a fraction of a percent difference between the genomes for whites and for blacks, they say. The genomes for the various races are far more similar than they are different. What they don't say, of course, is that there is only a fraction of a percent difference between the genome for white people and that for chimpanzees. In fact, there is only a very small percentage difference among the genomes for all the species of mammals. Most of the mammalian genome, whether it is for a white person, or a rat, or a negro, or a dog, contains instructions for how to synthesize hair, and skin, and nails, and bone, and milk, and teeth, and nerve tissue, and so on. Nearly all of the mammalian genome is taken up with these instructions, which are pretty much the same for all mammals. Only a tiny fraction of the mammalian genome is different for each species. But that tiny fraction of the mammalian genome that specifies whether the hair and skin and bone and other tissues will become a white person, or a rat, or a negro, or a dog, is important. The differences, small though they may seem compared to the similarities, are significant. Except to lemmings, of course, who really don't get it. White women baring their breasts in the presence of black males is an indication of just how lemming-like the normal whites are. Even back in Christian times, when the Mardi Gras festival was a much more significant thing than it is today, there was a sexual flavor to much of the revelry. But if a woman bared her breasts in a village Mardi Gras festival in those times, 200 or 300 years ago, say, there were only whites present, only members of her own tribe, her own racial family, and she could reasonably expect that she would not be sexually assaulted. There's an enormous difference between that and exposing herself to non-whites. But lemmings have been conditioned not to understand that. And so they really were surprised when the blacks in the crowd began behaving like blacks. It's not only the lie that we are all the same, that there are no significant differences between us and blacks, that made the whites in Seattle such easy victims for the blacks. It also is the abominable doctrine of the ideological individualists that it is immoral to judge people collectively. The racially destructive doctrine that it is immoral to deal with rioting blacks collectively. The individualists have preached that we should look only at individuals committing crimes against other individuals, and we should shut our eyes to the fact of blacks committing crimes collectively against whites. The individualists have preached that for whites even to notice what blacks collectively are doing to whites collectively, whether in a Mardi Gras festival or in our public schools or anywhere else, is wicked. It is racist. It is wicked to notice what the collective black presence in our society is doing to our society, to our civilization. We must judge each black individually. We must not organize a white posse and begin cracking black skulls when we see blacks collectively rampaging against our fellow whites the way they did in Seattle. These are poisonous doctrines, racially destructive doctrines, both the doctrine of sameness and the doctrine of individualism. Of course, there's more to it. There is the general softness, the generally feminized condition of young white males these days. And there was the presence of the wiggers in the crowd, blurring the distinction between whites and blacks. Altogether, as a race, we are in pretty sorry shape these days. It's really dangerous, and we need to do something about it. Get in touch with me, and I'll tell you what you and I together can do. Thanks for being with me again today.